Hi, everybody. My name is Elias Jabour from MD Anderson Leukemia Department, and I'm here with Sohei Insider. It's my pleasure to host my colleague and friend, Dr. Neville Dauber, today in this podcast on AML and other SOHO varieties. Neville, how are you doing today?
Hi, Eli. Very good, and looking forward to discussing with you.
Wonderful. Neville, for me, what's haunting me in my practice and what's haunting all the leukemia specialists and other cancer specialists is the P53 mutation. And I know you led extensive work on in this field, in AML in particular. First of all, I'd like you to tell me how common this problem is. Are all 50 mutations the same? And what has been done and what we learned from the past?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And it's a very difficult disease. I think among all of the molecular subsets in acute myeloid leukemia today, the one that has kind of the most unmet need and no improvement or breakthrough in the last 20, 25 years is unfortunately the group of TP53. So as you said, starting with what is the incidence, this is about 10 to 12% of all AML, if you take all aggregate, all ages, but it is particularly high in older patients above 65, the incidence can go up to 20, even 25%. And then in those AMLs, what we call therapy-related AML, so AML coming from a previous chemo for other diseases or previous radiation, they have up to 25, 30% TP53. And what's really important to note is that all the TP53s are not equal in their negative prognostic impact. So in general, we look at three factors, the TP53 allelic burden. If it is more than 40%, this is usually bad. Do they have co-occurring adverse cytogenetic or chromosome changes? If they do, that is bad. Or if they have more than one TP53, even with a low burden, that is bad. But there may be some TP53 who don't have any of these bad features and still have a low-level TP53 mutation, maybe a subclonal mutation, and we should treat those patients with intensive or appropriate best treatment and outcome. But I think what we have learned from a lot of research is that this is unlikely a disease like FLT3 or KMT2A-NPM1 where a single targeted therapy will be developed because TP53 impacts so many different functions, including the immune system, apoptosis, differentiation, senescence, that we probably will need a very total therapy approach, including transplant, cell therapy, immune modalities, all of these together, and it's going to take a lot of work.
But that being said, I want to focus on those who are progressing and acquiring P53 mutation clone, okay? Be it solid tumors or be it AML or anything, is there any way to prevent the emergence of this clone? Be it selecting our chemotherapy approach or doing something different. Let's say I want to give you breast cancer women who give adjuvant chemotherapy. If that can lead it to AML, maybe we can be smarter in a way we select our adjuvant treatment to avoid AML down the road. We know in ALN, for example, when you give the chemotherapy inobina, we're seeing emergence of a big clone with a 50 mutation. So anyway, we can prevent this from happening, or do we have an agent like in ALN, pH positive, uponative to suppress TFI mutation? Do we have something similar in AML?
So I think first question, is a good part that, now we are able to do a normal sequencing at very cheap rates and quickly in patients. So let's say you have a solid tumor, like you said, breast cancer, lymphoma, whatever it may be, and you identify a TP53 chip in the blood or bone marrow, meaning a very low level but present TP53. I think now there is ample data to show that if you just have a TP53 chip, majority of those patients actually will not go on to have a disease. It is not a high penetration chip if left unprovoked. But if you give them chemo and or radiation, a huge proportion of those will then become active and transform. So I do think in the future, and this is starting, but it will happen, we will do such sequencing and say, if you have such and such breast cancer, it's localized, you've done surgery, maybe do immunotherapy, you do pembrolizumab, maybe do Herceptin and avoid chemo, just as you are already doing, right, in ALL, where we say if we have TP53, let's not give Cytoxan, methotrexate, let's do Eno, Blina, and or TKI. So yes, this is a future direction, but it's just starting this train of thought.
No, we discussed if you have a young patient, if you have an old patient with a P53 mutation, anyway, intensive chemotherapy is not the way to go.
Yeah.
But if you have a young patient where he or she had this mutation and a mainly high VAF, you know, transplant is the way we cure them today, or at least we offer them a chance to cure. But my question, what is the role of intensive chemotherapy for this patient? Is it time to walk away from intensive chemotherapy to something more targeted or innovative in that sense?
I would say for the what we call true TP53 or biallelic TP53, high-risk TP53, all of these terms, where it's basically a lot of TP53 mutation plus adverse cyto, there's ample data now, many papers, many cooperative group study, hundreds of patients, they're showing intensive chemo is not improving outcome, causing more myelosuppression, toxicity, transfusion dependence, and even the transplant rates are similar. So I agree. I think here it is time to look at low-intensity therapies. HMA-based has shown activity in TP53 for decades, but then building on that with the new treatments, whether they're NK engagers, antibodies, macrophage-targeted therapies, and this is really what we do at MD Anderson, as you know. We try to enroll all these frontline patients on various trials, often low-intensity based.
So, Naval, that will bring to discuss treatment with you. I know there was high hopes on magrolimab at the time for AML and before with APR, another compound as well. So tell me with magrolimab, what happens here?
Yeah, so there were two drugs that were very exciting for TP53 specifically. These were designed in a way to be mutation agnostic or even more specifically hit TP53. One was the group of CD47 antibodies. They're called magrolimab was the first one, but then there were three or four others. And the other was the APR, which preclinically showed that it could change the folding of the TP53 protein, thereby keeping it in an active stage, not letting it become inactive. And both these drugs in single arm phase two, but relatively large phase two, like 60 to 70 patients, led by both MD Anderson and Moffitt, both of these studies showed very promising CR and complete response rates, 50 to 70%, much better than what we get with AZA venetoclax or AZA alone in AML and MDS. So these then went into the phase three studies. And unfortunately, both of the phase threes did not show what we were hoping. I think the reasons may be a little different. With the magrolimab, the issue of anemia through CD47 targeting was something that we knew about, had published and talked about, but it was manageable with big academic centers that have extensive transfusion support. But when this went into smaller academic centers that were involved, such as hundreds of trials in the phase three, I think this was one problem. There was also an issue that rose with infection and pneumonia. And again, a lot of this is how good prophylaxis is done, how infections are monitored and treated at the very big centers compared to the medium and smaller. And in the end, the study was negative in both MDS and AML. And in fact, this impacted the whole field with many CD47 antibodies now shutting down or moving away from development. The APR actually, I think, did have some activity. There was an increase in CR rate, 33 versus 22%. But I think the study was too ambitious. And I think we did not account that we will see a drop on CR from phase two to phase three. I think if it was a bigger study, this could have become positive, but other signals such as neurotoxicity also came up. So these may have been the issues. So I think what we learned from this is that we have to be very, very cautious in interpreting response rates, especially in these ultra high risk sets like TP53 MECOM, and probably either duration of response and or survival or maybe MRD, if we can do this well, will give us a better hint than jumping quickly to phase three. Yeah.
You know, this has passed now, and I'm glad we learned the lessons. What's new for this disease? What are you the most excited about in AML?
Yeah, I think for TP53 specifically, I cannot unfortunately say there is anything today that is showing great activity, even the phase ones. To me, I think eventually, and this may take a few years, and we're working extensively on it, cellular therapies are the hope. And these may actually be suited in either an MRD setting pre-transplant or even post-transplant, basically like a super DLI where you have a targeted NK product or a CAR T product that can be delivered multiple times with less GVHD post-transplant. And there are a couple of phase ones looking at that, our transplant group, and we're working on it. I think this will probably be the first initial way. And then in the future, maybe antibody-based therapy, CD123 ADCs have shown activity. These are moving frontline with HMA and HMA-VEN combos. These may help us get a response. But I think we will have to find an approach to treat this disease comprehensively from the beginning, MRD-directed, transplant planned right away from day one. We do this now, get them to transplants in 60 to 70 days. And then post-transplant, either DLIs or cell therapies given every 3 to 4 weeks, very aggressive. And hopefully then we can cure more percentage of patients.
That's very informative, Naval. Thank you so much. Before I conclude this podcast, you and me have been involved together in advocating for SOHO and helping organizing SOHO worldwide, for me, the most memorable one was Middle East, MENA, Beirut 2 years ago. Can you remind the SOHO insiders of what we did this year? What are the plans for SOHO outside USA? I know we did together Italy virtual and Spain, Madrid, but what's coming next?
Yeah, Ali, this is great. And I think very close to both you and my heart and, you know, others who have been working very closely and hard with us to expand SOHO globally beyond its already very high reputation in the United States. So now we have many SOHO. SOHO Brazil is a big one that has done really well in collaboration with our friend Dr. Scheinberg. As SOHO Turkey, we're going there soon. It's growing, also a nice one. We did a SOHO India, and I agree with you. I think the SOHO Lebanon one in Beirut was one of the most exciting for me. Great people, great time, a lot of good discussion, education, and also some good food and good times, which is important. But I think this is a testament to SOHO, you know, itself, that we and the SOHO team like to share the knowledge and education and even protocols and collaborations. It is really just a mission to increase education. So hopefully, you know, with you, me and our team and the SOHO team, we can continue to work on this. What are your thoughts? Yeah,
that's wonderful. I echo everything you said, and I'm eager for next less than a month. We have SOHO Istanbul coming. And then we have SOHO Middle East as well, hopefully in September. And, you know, it's we were fortunate to be where we are. And it's our part. It's our duty to give back to people and to help them. And that is this mission of SOHO. And we endorse it fully and look forward for more successes. Thank you so much for being with me today. Thanks a lot. And I'll see you around. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.